This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. And join our upcoming conversation with Cal Deal. We're going to be talking about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, are you there?
I'm there. Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm really glad that you're able to be with us. We've been having a lot of problems with phones today, and you're here. You're joining us. We really appreciate it to talk about the other side of the hurricane, because as we all know, with the release of the movie, the hurricane with Denzel Washington, and certainly the Bob Dylan song, we've heard a tremendous amount about the case of Hurricane Carter. Now, you actually covered this original crime when it happened. Is that correct?
Well, I worked on the case in the 1970s. The crime itself actually happened in 1966.
Right.
And I got involved when Carter was trying to win his second trial and went down to the state prison to do an interview and take pictures and just basically plunged into the case with both feet at that point. And I went into it thinking Carter was innocent, but in a few months after talking to him and then looking at the record, I began to think otherwise.
Well, let's talk about why you began to think otherwise. And first, I guess, let me share with the audience that, in part, the way I came to be in contact with you were some news reports about some of the original witnesses in the case, Patty Valentine, Mr. Bello, and others who actually went and saw the film and expressed their just outrage at what they were referring to as Hollywood justice and a rewriting of history. As I understand it, you've remained or have had at least a significant amount of contact with these people, correct?
Well, Pat Valentine is somebody that I've stayed in touch with for the last 25 years. She was, I guess you could say, she was the star witness in the case because she was the one with the most credibility. And she is the woman who lived above the bar where the triple murder took place. She heard the shots. She heard her friend Hazel Tanis screaming, "Oh, no." This was 2:30 in the morning, remember. She raced to the window, looked out, and saw a car and saw two black men run to it and drive away. And she said that she knew that she had to remember what that car looked like because she knew something terribly wrong had happened downstairs. And she stared at that car until it went out of view. And from that day to this, she said that the car that she saw was Reuben Carter's car, and she identified it within an hour of the crime.
Well, let me ask you, how was she so sure that this was Reuben Carter's car?
Well, it was a very unusual car. Now, first of all, you have to remember, it's 2:30 in the morning in Paterson, New Jersey. That's not Manhattan. There aren't a lot of cars on the road at that hour. The car was brand new. It was a Dodge Polara, I believe was the model. It had, so it was shiny and clean and new. It had very unusual taillights. It had what was described as butterfly taillights. They're sort of triangular shaped from the middle of the car. They fan out toward the edge in the back. It also had out-of-state plates, which greatly limits the number of potential cars in the universe of cars in Paterson. And then black occupants. So the car was very, very unusual and very distinctive, and particularly because of those butterfly taillights. Both Pat and Al Bello, who was burglarizing a place around the corner at that time, saw that car, and Bello described it so well that the police went looking for it because they had just stopped Carter a few minutes after the murders. So it was a very distinctive car.
We're talking with Cal Deal. We're talking about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, we have been presented in the popular media and press with, in essence, I'm paraphrasing, a case of a man who was framed, who was on his way to being the middleweight champion of the world, who was robbed of his career by racism, illegally convicted of a horrible triple murder because he was black, by a racist police officer in a racist system. You've been investigating this case for over 20 years. I know you have a website that has a lot of documentation on it. Let's talk about what are the differences in your perception of the reality of this case and this situation and what we're being presented with in the popular media with the movie and rock songs and so forth and so on?
Well, Dylan's song is inaccurate and false. I mean, I hate to tell people that because a lot of people like the song so much.
It's a good song.
Oh, it's a great song, but it's just not factually accurate. Dylan didn't do his homework, and he took the word of a twice-convicted triple murderer and wrote the song based on that. And so you've got exactly what you could expect when your source material is so biased. Carter, you mentioned that he was at the peak of his career. In reality, if you check his record for the last year and a half of his career, which is the time when the murders took place, his record was 7-7. So he was, I think, he peaked around 1964, and he was on his way down at that point. As far as the racism and the racist prosecution, first of all, I think Carter, because of his status, I mean, he was well-known in Patterson and elsewhere, and because of that, I think he was treated differently. Yeah, he was treated more carefully because the cops, really couldn't believe that a guy who had that much going for him would go in and commit a triple murder. But there wasn't, they always talk, and particularly in the movie, they talk about the racism and all that, and they have that really horrible racist detective. Well, I knew the real detective that's supposed to be, although now they're backtracking and saying that's a composite. But Lieutenant Vince DeSimone was I describe him as a big teddy bear of a man. I mean, he was sort of corny in his concern about reputation and so on, and he was just an honest cop, and he did his job. And now they've had to slam him, but he was not a racist. I haven't personally seen any evidence of racism concerning this case. I haven't heard anybody make racist comments about Carter. This is just what Carter has to do to discredit the information that was gathered against him. He just uses that broad brush of tarring it with racism, and it's really not true. He got special treatment, but it was positive treatment because they let him go on the day of the crimes, even though DeSimone thought that Carter and Artis were involved because they figured, well, he's a big name, he's not going to go anywhere. And so the racism, if this was racism, this prosecution was racist, I wouldn't have anything to do with it, and you wouldn't be seeing that website on the Internet.
We're talking with Cal Deal. We're talking about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, let's talk a little bit more about racism, because I know that you've been accused of being a racist because you are doing this website and attempting to challenge what's being put forth in the movie. Is that correct?
Yeah, I when I first put up the website, it's only been up for about a little over 2 months now, I started getting a lot of hate mail accusing me of being this white racist pig. And so I put up a page that explains my attitudes toward or concerning racism, which is that I think it's the product of small minds, and I am definitely not a racist. I also tried to point out that the prosecutor who's the man who went into court on the second trial and said Reuben Carter pulled the trigger on the shotgun, he had been a member of the NAACP, and a civil rights activist, and he made sure that there were blacks on the jury in that second trial, even though he could have had them removed from the jury with those peremptory challenges that they have. He didn't do that. He wanted blacks to be on the jury, even though the other prosecuting attorney thought he was a little crazy for doing that. But that's the way he is. He was a very, ethical, honest person, and it's definitely not a racist. Lieutenant DeSimone wasn't a racist. And I don't live in La La Land. I mean, I realize that there are racist cops and racists running all over the place. But in this case, I don't think that it was a racially motivated prosecution at all. And the movie makes it seem completely racist, and the movie is just misleading everybody who sees it, and that's a shame.
We're talking with Cal Deal, a reporter who has covered the other side of the hurricane, if you will. Mr. Deal, let me ask you, you said you went and interviewed Hurricane Carter. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, the first time I went to interview him was in August of 1975, and he was in state prison at that time, and this is my first contact with him. I prepared by reading clip files, and we went down there and talked to him. He was a relatively nice guy. I mean, he was trying, we were from the biggest paper in the county where the crimes took place, and so obviously he wanted to positively impress us, and he was very passionate and made good statements, good arguments, and it was overall very impressive. The thing that disturbed me was that we, as a litmus test, we decided to offer him a lie detector test. We said, we'll pay for it if you'll take it. And he said no. And that, you know, I mean, we all know the realities of lie tests. They're not perfect, and they're just used as a rule, you know, as an investigative tool. But the fact that he said no bothered us. And then we went and checked what he had told us about the case against the record and found out that a lot of what he said was flat out not true. And unfortunately, most of the reporters today don't check what he says against the record, and so they just repeat what he says, and the people who read those stories don't know that they're getting bad information. The second time I interviewed him was in December, and by that time I had written a lot of stories that were negative about his case, and as soon as he realized who I was, he started calling me a racist and verbally attacking me. I almost walked out of the interview until the TV reporter calmed him down, and but he was very upset with the reporting that I had done.
Let me ask you what some of those discrepancies are. I mean, because on the one hand, I mean, we have a man, he was convicted of a triple homicide.
Right.
Somehow or another, he managed to convince somebody that enough to be released from prison. How does this happen if he's so guilty?
Well, he was released, and most people don't realize this, that he was released for two reasons, and they were both procedural errors by the prosecution. It wasn't because the evidence wasn't there. The defense managed to get hooked up with a very liberal judge, and the judge ruled that because the racial revenge theory was used in the trial to explain how all the events of that night fit together, and because part of a lie detector test that was taken by Al Bello, the witness who saw Carter and Artis outside the bar, because part of that test hadn't been turned over to the defense, that he was going to throw out the whole case. And so the weight of the evidence was still there, was still intact. And in fact, the introduction of the racial revenge motive was done by the defense because they played a key tape recording in which the detective explains the racial revenge theory. And that's how it got introduced into the trial, and yet the judge used that as a way of overturning the case.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. Regarding the alleged racial revenge motive, as I understand it, there had been an allegedly racially motivated shooting and/or killing of some white men.
Well, there was a murder earlier in the evening, 6.5 hours before the Lafayette Grill triple murder, in which a black man essentially had his head blown off by a white man with a shotgun. That was a business dispute, though. The black man owed the white man money. He was buying the building and didn't pay him, and the white man just took it out on him with a shotgun. But the black man who was killed was the stepfather of a friend of Reuben Carter's. Reuben Carter was with the person that night. That person was very angry and was quoted as saying in the police headquarters, "If you don't take care of it, I will." And that's believed to be the cause of the revenge murder later in the night at the Lafayette Grill, because there was a lot of anger. I mean, you know, the 60s were racially tense times, and so there was a lot of anger when the word spread around about this black man being killed, and there was talk of what they called a shaking, which was just certainly not murder, but it was just trying to get even in some way. And then hours later, Carter, who had gone around looking for guns that had been stolen from him between the time of the two murders, went to the Lafayette Grill, according to the prosecution's case.
And as I understand it, and once again, just with my cursory knowledge of the incident, as I understand it, the police actually stopped the car that Hurricane Carter was in after the killing at the grill and let them go, then stopped them later and actually found shells that were similar to the types that were used in the killing?
Right. I mean, and that's interesting. He was stopped just 10 minutes after the shootings and only 6 minutes after the police went out. And he was lying down in the back seat of the car when the police pulled him over. There was an artist driving, and he was in the he was hiding in the back seat. The police, the call had gone out for two blacks in a car, and there were three in that car when Carter got up off the seat, and so the police let him go. They went to the scene of the murders. They heard Al Bello's description of the car, and it exactly matched the Carter's car that they had just let go, and they went back out looking for him. And then they brought him to the scene and took them in for questioning, searched their car about an hour and 15 minutes after the murders, and found a .32 caliber shell, a live round, and a live shotgun shell inside the car. And those rounds matched the caliber of the murder weapons. That was the significance of them, that they matched the caliber. So here you had a car that perfectly matched the description of the eyewitnesses, and it had shells that perfectly matched the murder weapons. And that was two of the key elements of the case against him.
We're talking with Cal Deal, a reporter who covered the Hurricane Carter story. We're talking about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, let me ask you, because you started to say something about Hurricane Carter making statements and reporters not doing their homework and checking these against the record. Can you talk about what some of those were?
For instance, he was just up in Canada last week and made some statement that the courts said I was not guilty. The courts have never said he was not guilty. No judge or jury has ever found him not guilty. His case, as I explained earlier, was thrown out on technicalities, and yet he gets in front of the press and the public up in, I forget what city it was Lincoln, Nebraska, and tells them that the courts found him not guilty. Absolutely false. When I interviewed him once, he told me that the man who survived the killings, Willie Marins, he was shot in the head but survived, that Willie Marins had testified at trial that Carter and Artis were not the gunmen. Willie Marins made no such testimony, and in fact, I used Carter's own book in that interview to prove it. So those are the kinds of things that he will say to people, and most people do not know the facts of the case, can't question him, can't dispute him, and he gets away with it. And then the people read the stories and they think, well, you know, must be true. It's in the paper.
Go ahead.
Well, and that's why we have the problem that we have. Dylan, when, you know, his song came out and it's full of bad information, and, you know, people believe Dylan. And so, unfortunately, that's why I put a verse-by-verse critique of the song on the website, because I wanted people to see that it's not reflective of the truth and what's on the record, the testimony.
The larger aspect of all of this is, I think, going on the basis that we accept, you know, your view of this, that Hurricane Carter is guilty of these crimes and somehow or another managed to get off on technicalities. We have this larger issue of popular media more or less taking a story, rewriting history. That's what the vast majority of people are exposed to. They therefore accept that as being the truth, and that sort of becomes the popular official history of the case, correct?
Right, and that's why I put the website online, because knowing what I knew about the case and seeing what was happening with this movie and with this story, and that Carter was being invited to the White House and he's getting standing ovations at colleges and universities, and he's being treated like a conquering hero. And knowing what I knew about the case, I just couldn't sit idly by and not try and get the word out. And so I started building the website 2 months ago. Now, he's been out of prison for 15 years, but none of us, the families or nor I, have done anything about it. But now that he's starting to be paraded around the country in the way he is, we just couldn't stomach that. And even though it cost me money and time and is a major distraction for me, I just felt strongly enough about it that I had to do it. I don't try to make any money off this. I don't make any money off this. I lose money, in fact. But I just want people to know. And I get hundreds and hundreds of appreciative emails from people who said, I just had no idea until I saw your website.
Go ahead.
And the other side, you know, they come on. I did a radio show in New York with Lewis Steele, who was John Artis' attorney last week. And they come on and they immediately try to discredit the website, and they say it's got partial information and phony documents and all this sort of thing. But, you know, I was a newspaper reporter and I have ethical standards, and I'm not going to put stuff online that I think is not true. And so, you know, your listeners can rest assured that what they're getting there are you know, good information, and as best as I can provide it to them.
We're talking with Cal Deal about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, I want to talk about this because, you know, certainly there have been people, and I think you've addressed it, who have said, oh, this is just a guy, he's trying to trade off of this movie and, you know, make some sort of name for himself or something like that. I know that from reading, a lot of the people who have been involved with this are really upset. Some of them are personally involved. Some of them are family members of people who were personally involved who are now deceased. I understand that one boxer is suing the makers of the film, saying they've misrepresented him and his career. Why are you doing this?
Well, it's just simply a right and wrong thing. I mean, you know, I have the ability, because I was a journalist for so many years, to communicate, and I know how to build a website, and when I learned about the movie and the book, and I just got a copy of the book, Lazarus and the Hurricane, that was used to make the movie about 3 months ago. So all of this has just mushroomed suddenly. But, you know, as I said before, knowing what I know about the case and feeling as strongly as I do that the guy is guilty, and seeing firsthand how he lies about the record and lies about the case and misleads people, I just didn't think I could just sit back and let it ride, let him get away with it without being challenged. And thank God the internet gives us this unique opportunity of getting information to a wide number of people very efficiently. Joey Giardello, the boxer you referred to, he was the middleweight champion of the world and fought Carter in the fight that's depicted in the movie. The reporters who were at that fight said that Giardello won. And even Reuben Carter has said in January, I'm told, that Giardello won that fight. Yet the movie shows Giardello being beaten to a pulp and then the judges declaring Giardello the winner. And, you know, it looks like another one of the conspiracies against Carter. But in reality, Carter lost that fight, and the people who were there say so.
I talked with a friend of mine who happened to have watched the fight as well, and he said it was a controversial decision, but certainly not a one-sided fight where Carter had won, as is depicted in the film.
Yeah, I mean, and you see the man playing Giardello in the movie, I mean, his eyes are all puffy, and he looks like he hasn't slept in a week, and he's been beaten to a pulp, and you know, he's clearly visually, you know, the loser of that fight, and yet, and then there's this long delay of 35 minutes before they announce the decision, and some announcer, when they announce it, says, he's been robbed, you know. But actually, the reporters who were there, and Giardello has this up on his website, said that scored the fight in Giardello's favor. I mean, it wasn't, you know, 15 rounds to nothing or whatever, it was, but he clearly won it. And Carter himself has apparently said that in January, so I don't think it's in dispute any longer.
We're talking with Cal Deal. We're talking about the other side of the hurricane. Mr. Deal, a couple of questions come to my mind in just the few minutes that we have left. Mm-hmm. One is that if Hurricane Carter is so clearly lying and so clearly guilty, as you so state from your perspective, and you know much more about the case than I do, why is it that more reporters are not dealing with this, in your opinion?
Well, I, a few are, but I think that a lot of it has to do with the amount of time it takes to properly cover this story and get to the bottom of it. You know, if a reporter goes to a press conference and Carter says, the courts found me not guilty, they write it down and put it in their story, and it goes in the paper, and they go on to another story the next day. Most people don't spend the time that I did to go back and read the transcripts and, you know, look at the case in some detail and see what the evidence was against him. And that's why he gets away with it. In the 70s, it started with the New York Times. They wrote a story that was very pro-Carter, and they were consistently pro-Carter. And everyone else sort of tagged along. They, you know, they didn't do their independent research and just basically took the New York Times' word for it. I came along and I started giving the other side of the story back then, and people in the press thought I was a little bit misguided, but I don't think so, and I still don't think so.
We've been speaking with Cal Deal. I'm sorry, you had another thought?
No, that was it.
We've been speaking with Cal Deal. We've been talking about the other side of the hurricane, and Mr. Deal has been covering and investigating the Hurricane Carter case for quite some time. Any final thoughts for our audience today?
No, I just wish that people would take a look at the website with an open mind. Don't assume the worst of the detectives because it was the 60s. Not everyone was a racist in the 60s. These were good people who did an honest job, and they felt then and they feel now that they had the right man.
Let's make sure that people who want to take a look at the website have the correct URL. If you could give that to them, please.
Sure. It's www.graphicwitness.com/Carter.
So it's www.graphicwitness.com/Carter?
That's right.
Cal Deal, thank you for being with us on the program to talk about the other side of the hurricane today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.